bring a superstar researcher up here to talk about and introduce you to give you sort of a window into what theoretical physics is doing today, what's happening in theoretical physics today, what are some of the greatest unsolved mysteries. So if you decide to become a theoretical physicist, you can get a sense of all the different unanswered questions out there that you might want to work on. So I'm really delighted that today we have Pedro Viana. He's a string theorist here at Perimeter, and he's going to be giving you a talk called String Theory and Holography. You have his biography, so I won't read it. Very, very impressive. He received an early researcher award and all kinds of stuff, which just tells you that he's a really smart guy with great ideas. He's also a very nice guy, and he loves questions. Let's give Pedro a warm, I just like you welcome.
Okay, thank you very much. So it's my pleasure to tell you a bit about string theory, holography, and those kind of ideas. So please do interrupt me a lot. So I don't have anything very strict planned. I just have a bunch of keywords just to so that I don't get totally lost into divagations. So, but I do hope by the end of the lecture to give you a flavor of what this crazy, crazy, crazy idea that tells us that reality might actually be an hologram is all about. So what we want to do in theoretical physics, one of the major open problems today, as you, I'm sure, read in popularization books or heard while at PI, is to unify quantum mechanics and general relativity. So that's quite a challenge, and it's one that until recently seemed very, very hard. And what I'm going to tell you is of one possible solution to that very big question of unifying together gravity and quantum mechanics. So my plan is to tell you first a bit about gravity, a bit about general relativity, then some about quantum mechanics, then what happens when we try to put the two together, what kind of puzzles we get when we start studying quantum mechanics in the presence of black holes, and then at the end, I'll touch upon holography. So I will try not to write formulas, just because the formulas I would write would have symbols that you don't know, like integrals, tensors, and such objects that are kind of hard for you to decode. That means that I will hand wave a lot. So I will have to hand wave and to give sloppy arguments, and some people get very nervous with that. I do. So it is your task to stop me with questions, to tell what exactly do you mean, be a bit more precise and so on, if you do want me to do it. So let's then start with gravity. So gravity, right now, the way we understand gravity, the way we understand planets moving in space-time, stars moving in space-time, is by this nice kind of picture that I drew beforehand because I thought that it would take me 10 times before I could draw it properly, but actually, at the first try, it was already more or less reasonable, which is the picture that if you put some heavy object in space-time, it reforms space-time, like some kind of rubber is deformed if I put a big ball on top of that rubber. You probably all read about this picture in some book, or you have seen it online. Is this correct? That everyone more or less saw this picture of putting some very heavy bowling ball and deforming space-time. And then if you kick some small ball on this deformed rubber, it will just follow the natural path just because space-time is curved. And with this picture, there's no need for thinking about action at a distance of a particle exerting some force on some other particle. There's no such thing as forces that are generated at a big distance. It's all about moving in some curved space-time. So here in the middle, we have something heavy. We have some matter, a bunch of particles, lots and lots of particles. And that matter generates a space-time. It deforms the space-time and creates this curved space-time where particles move. And Einstein told us how to do that precise, how geometry gets deformed by the presence of matter. And actually, there are some equations due to Einstein called Einstein equations that do exactly that, that some object which encodes geometry is equal to some other object that encodes matter. And by solving this equation, the solutions to these equations are space-time. Okay? So the goal, normally you have some equations for the trajectory of the particle. The solution is the trajectory. Here you have some equations for the shape of space-time. The solution is the shape of space-time. So just to give you a small flavor, so the solutions to these equations are space-times. So what kind of math is involved into this kind of equations? So you are all used to dealing with vectors, right? So you can have a vector. What's a vector? A vector is just like a small arrow, which you can pick some initial point, some final point, and it has some direction. It has some pointer at the end, right? So what's a vector? A vector is just, it's more or less just a list of numbers, right? You just have A, B, C, some list of numbers, or normally you put this kind of brackets. Right? Just a list of numbers. But it's a bit more than a list of numbers. It's a bit subtle. I'm not expecting you to come up with what exactly more than a list of numbers is, but let me try anyway. Can someone have a guess for what else? Is a vector just a list of three numbers, a vector in space? Or what is special about this list of numbers? Sorry? Energy? Direction. Right. Direction is encoded into this list of vectors. If this is the origin, right? If A, B, C are positive, if I choose my axis to be Z, X, Y, for example, if the arrow is pointing in this direction, means that A, B, and C are all positive, right? So if A, B, and C are negative, it's pointing in towards the back of the board. That's encoded in the list of vectors. What is more special about this list of vectors? Is that these vectors is a geometrical quantity. It's really this arrow. It's really this arrow here. And I chose this x, y, z axis, but I could choose some other axis completely different, right? Someone else could choose some axis like this, where this is x, this is z, and this is y. You see, I tilted the axis. And for the orange guy, this would be the vector. But for the blue guy, it would be something. You see, the vector is pointing in the x direction. So there's something in the x direction, nothing in the y direction, nothing in the z direction. Because I chose some nice x's where the vector is pointing in the x direction. So a vector is a list of numbers which represents a geometrical object, and where I know how this list changes when I change my coordinates, when I change my axis. It is just a convenient way of representing some geometrical vector. The vector is always this. It's always here. I could imagine it here floating in space. But then different people choose different coordinates, so they represent it as different lists. Okay? This is what a vector is. I'm just trying to give you a flavor of what's the kind of mathematical objects that enter Einstein equations. Now you can imagine, so this is a vector. It's a list of numbers, which is a geometrical object, and there's something called a tensor. And the tensor, instead of being a list, it is a table. It's just a table of numbers that encodes more than a vector. Okay, it is more of a two-dimensional structure. Again, with some geometrical transformation. And the Einstein equation tells you that a certain geometrical tensor is equal to a certain matter tensor. Okay? But at this point, I would have to go into the mathematics if I would like to explain you more about these equations, but I just want to give you a flavor. So there are such objects which are geometrical generalizations of vectors, which are tensors, and gravity is basically an equation that tells that some tensor in geometry is equal to some tensor in matter. And there are rules for adding up these tensors, subtracting tensors, and so on, just like there are rules for adding up vectors. A vector plus some other vector is equal to just you put the two vectors one after the other, and you get the resulting vector. Right? So this is the result of adding up two vectors, and in the same way, there are rules for manipulating tensors and so on. And this is what GR gives. What general relativity or what gravity is, technically. Now, let's explore the solutions to this equation, the possible spacetimes that you can get. For example, suppose we say that we put no matter. So we say we are empty. We put nothing. We just say geometry equals zero, if you want, in a sense. We put nothing. We decide to put, again, empty. Once again, please stop me with questions. Tell me to be more precise. Hit me. You should really, it's your role to make sure that this doesn't get into something completely incomprehensible. So suppose we put totally empty space, totally no matter at all. What kind of space-time do you expect to get? Yeah, just empty space-time, just totally boring space-time, nothing special, nothing curved, just time goes by, I can walk, I can move, nothing curved, nothing. So one solution, okay, the first example, is empty space. Indeed, if you plug empty space in these equations, you see that geometry, this is basically curvature of geometry, is zero because the space is flat, it's not curved. And on the right, you get zero because you don't put matter. So indeed, you get zero equals zero, it's a good solution. Okay? No matter, no curvature. So how do we represent space-time? Well, we can represent time going up, space going horizontally. So these kind of diagrams you saw a lot in Richard's lectures, right? Where time and space goes up. As you saw, it's very convenient to choose some kind of crazy scale where we put 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. And then what's the crazy scale that I should that is quite convenient to put here? Sorry? A meter? Meter is not such a good idea. We could put 1 meter, as Weldon said. But instead, let me put 300 million meters. Yes?
We had it flipped around. We did CT versus X.
Ah, you did T there and X upstairs?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So then, I would get totally confused if I would do that, so I will rather.
But just for the kids to know this.
That's right.
Same thing Richard did, but we're going to go to.
Okay, so normally we had space vertical and T horizontal. I could do it. Would you really prefer?
No, do your thing. Let them see how you think.
Very good. And I'll be going to put 300 meters. By the way, some people might not be like meters. Some people like the other units, which I don't even know what they are, inches or something like that. So, and then the second tick would be 600 million meters, 900, and so on. And why is this a convenient scale to put 1 second and then these many meters? What happens? What happens in these many meters in 1 second? This is the distance that light travels in 1 second, right? So the speed of light is this many meters per second. So light rays, if I pick a point and I throw a light ray in all directions, I just draw some lines going at 45 degrees, right? And this is very useful. For example, us in this room, or me, who is walking left and right as I'm speaking, I would be totally here in the middle, right? So this is me. I would not move at all because, I'm walking like 10 meters or something. In this scale, it's absolutely irrelevant. So all of us, airplanes, everything, would be just standing in the middle. But we are speaking about, we want to discuss interesting relativistic stuff where the velocities are huge. And then if someone would be very, very fast, it could move here. Because this is someone fast. Now, this diagram, it looks like a very trivial diagram. So these rays, I threw a ray in to the left, I threw one to the right, but of course, this is a two-dimensional picture. I could throw it in all directions, right? So I have rays going in all possible directions. So a three-dimensional version of this picture is I'm here, I throw rays in all directions, and I have a cone, which is called the light cone. Okay? And this light cone, or that two-dimensional depiction of the light cone, it has already some interesting structure. There are quite already some regions we can represent. So let's see. So this is where we are. Of course, this is time. I hope, again, I'm not confusing you by changing time and space. Time goes up. Okay, so if I'm standing at some point in space, I'm here and time is moving up. So my line is just this vertical line going up, not an horizontal line. And then, well, if this is where I am, this part is the future. And this part to the back of this line is the past. Right? But now there is some difference. The future can be outside this light cone or inside the light cone. Right? So I can have the future to the above this dashed line, which is a plane above this plane here. But there's still a difference if I am above the plane and inside the light cone or outside the light cone. What's the physical difference? Imagine I'm here, and I want to distinguish this point and this point. Why are they very different, Matthew?
When you have to exceed light speed to reach the point outside the cone.
That's right. Can I go to the point in the right? I cannot, because if I would want to go there, I would have to get out of the light cone, which means that my velocity needs to be bigger than the speed of light. But it's impossible to go above the speed of light. So we have two different futures. We have this future outside the light cone, which is the future that we cannot influence. And we have this part inside the light cone, which is the future that we can influence. I can decide to go there. Imagine this is a point in space and time. Imagine it's the birthday of someone. And I can go to their house and give them a present. But if someone else has a birthday right here at some other time, if it's too far away, I will not get there. Even if I go very fast, I would have to go faster than the speed of light. What about the past? Similarly, in the past, I have points inside the light cone and points outside the light cone. Points outside is the past that cannot have influenced me. So someone here, that is something very important, but I couldn't have known about it because I would have, the signal would have to travel faster than light to get inside my light cone. And these points here are the past that might have influenced me. So I might have passed by this point. I might have attended some special events, and this might have influenced me. I might have liked it a lot. I might have received some present. Something might have happened. Now, if I would like to draw this strictly speaking, I would have to use all the blackbirds and go on, because space is infinite, right? So I would have to go all the way here and say, by the way, this is still a point in the, this is still one in the future, this is still one in the future, but this is kind of useless. I would like to have some kind of diagram where I could represent all this interesting information about causality, about what can influence what. I can influence this. This cannot influence me. This cannot have influenced me, and so on. And I would like this diagram to represent this, what's called the causal structure of space-time, in some finite piece of napkin. So I'd like to have a napkin and to draw in the coffee shop and draw to some friend. So this is the space-time. This is all the causal structure of the space-time, and I don't need to go to have some infinite piece of paper. So let's try to come up with such diagrams that encode causality of space-time and that bring infinity to some finite distance. Okay? So in this kind of diagrams, of course, we are drawing the whole universe in a napkin. We don't care about scale. We don't care about this is 1/100th of the of this distance, because if it was just a scale, of course, I would still need an infinite piece of paper. So of course, we don't care about scale. But we do want to care about causal structure. So we want light cones to continue to be 45 degrees. This is what we want. The rest, we don't care. OK? So let me give you this diagram for this space-time. So So let's say that all these points at infinity here are green. All these points at infinity from this side are green. All these points at infinity, but at some distance here, are this orange. All these points here in the past are orange. And now I will draw a diagram where all these points at infinity are just one point. All these points in the past are just one point. So this means time goes to minus infinity, any space. There will be two points that will represent space goes to this direction, to infinity, any possible time. And there will be another point here that represents space goes to the left at any possible time. And then the diagram we are after is just a tilted square. This is the claim. So let's see that this works. Let's see that this funny diagram, this diamond, does the job. And if you give this to someone that knows gravity and knows relativity, he will immediately tell you this is empty space. Let's see. Let's suppose we are here. Okay? And now let me draw my light cone. I draw the light cone at 45 degrees. Okay? So you see that in the past of the light cone there is this point, which means that in the future of this light cone, sorry, in the past of this light cone there is this orange line. In the future of this light cone there is the orange line, and outside there are the two green points. This seems to match. Okay? But let's do it a bit better. Let's pick someone else. So this is person A, this is person B. And let's draw the light cone of person B. And this is it. So you see that by drawing this, let's draw one possible trajectory for A and one possible trajectory for B. So the life of A could have been something like this, something always inside the light cone of A. And the trajectory of B something inside the light cone of B could have been something like this. Okay? Let me maybe draw the light cone of B in blue so that you can visualize better. So you see the blue line is inside the blue light cone. And let me draw the light cone of A in green. Should I lift the blackboard a bit? Can you see properly? Can you see? So this is a, let's describe the story, the biography of these two guys. A and B existed forever. This is schematic. They met at some point. They crossed their paths. They studied in the same university. Then they split their ways. And then at some point they met again. And this can happen many times. This is the story of people. So anyone in the universe, if you have enough time to travel, can meet, you can meet anyone else. Right? If you have infinite amount of time, you travel wherever you want, you meet whoever you want. And then you can split again and then meet again and so on. So all the causality is encoded in this diagram. So this region is the region where A and B could have met, and this is the region where A and B can meet again, in the same way that whenever I draw two light cones, when I draw two light cones in the usual diagram, which just goes on for infinity, I have this same kind of region. So this region here is that intersection there, and this region in the past here is that other one there. So this diagram, notice that it's very important that the square is tilted. Because we just drew this funny tilted square, we encoded all the same information about causality as just drawing with an infinite piece of paper. Okay? If you think for a bit, it is crucial that the square is tilted like this. Okay. Any question? So I'll give you another spacetime now. Now that we have some experience drawing these funny diagrams, these diagrams, by the way, are called Penrose diagrams. They are diagrams that people who work on gravity and who study spacetimes when you want to show someone the space-time, you don't typically show them these big tensors with all these entries that you look at it and you have to think a lot to understand what the space-time is. What you do is you draw one of these cartoons and you show them. And the person looks at it, starts drawing these light cones and say, okay, this, I can go this. If I go there, I cannot get out. If I go here, I can meet this one. And you understand all the logical structure. You understand how it would be to live in such space-time. It's exactly as if you get the plant of some house where you are going to live. It's not up to scale, but you see the kitchen is close to the bedroom, the bedroom is close to the living room, and you get an idea of how it would be to live in such space. So this is exactly the same. It gives you the picture of how can I communicate. I can communicate with this guy can communicate with me, and so on. We see that any two points can communicate with any two points. Let's consider another space-time. Let's not tilt the square. Let's consider this space-time. This is not empty space-time. Guesses. What could this space-time be? Yes. It does matter. It is curved. This is a curved space-time. Any guesses what it could be? Well, let's try to analyze how it would be to live in such space-time. There's a guess?
A good guess here, I heard it.
There was a guess somewhere. No one is brave enough? Yes?
Is it a black hole?
Could be a black hole. Let's see, maybe it's a black hole. Let's see if it makes sense to be a black hole. But let's see what it is, actually. Let's suppose we are here. This is me, and this is you. And let's draw the light cones to see where we can go and where could we have come from. Okay? So we can go here, and we could have come from here. And here, we can go here, and we could have come from here. There is a region where we could have met. Okay? But there's no region in the future where we can meet again. No matter what we do, we cannot meet again. We could have met in the past. Okay? But no matter what we do next, no matter how fast we try, we are not going to meet each other. So maybe we met in the past, but we are not going to meet again. Similarly, let me draw the same diagram. I could have someone in the past, and we could not have met in the past, but okay, luckily, we can meet in the future. So there exist such situations where you can meet in the future, but you can never meet in the past. So how can you imagine such space-time? Where I am here, someone else is in a very faraway galaxy, and no matter what we try, we cannot meet. So what space-time could this be? Guesses. What space-time can you imagine that life would be like this? You try to meet someone, you walk always to the left, he always walks to the right, and you never meet each other. Who said someone?
Is it finite?
Sorry?
Is it finite?
It's not finite, it's infinite. But space-time, flat space-time is also infinite. But if we walk a lot, we eventually meet each other, right? I mean, I can put a point here, I can put some other point in some nearby city, and then draw the light cones, and eventually they meet, and we can go and meet each other. But here we cannot. Very good. So as Alex said, the idea is that this is an expanding space-time. And because space is expanding, the distance between us is increasing. So even if we go towards each other, because space-time is expanding, A and B can never meet. So we try, but we never meet. So the picture that describes this space-time is a space-time that is expanding. Imagine that this will be the cartoon. Space-time, the size of space-time, as time evolves, would be expanding. Right? And because time is expanding, if I'm here and if you are here, even if we try to meet to go and meet each other, because space is increasing between us, our distance between ourselves is always increasing. If it expands fast enough, right? If it expands very slowly, we can run and eventually meet each other. But you can imagine that if the growth of the universe is exponential, which is what this universe is, then there's no way we can run, but the universe wins. What about the past? There's also this story that we cannot meet, that if we are, that the same story happens when we flip time. So what happens is that the universe was very big and it contracted and then expanded again. And again, if we are here and here, we could not have met in the past, because in the past, the universe was shrinking a lot, and well, it's just a time reverse of this. But of course, we can move now, in this particular example, meet in the future, then decide to stay close to each other. But if we separate a lot, then okay, bad luck. Now we cannot meet again. Okay? Yes?
So, like you said, the universe was big, then it shrunk, and then expanded again.
Can that's true.
Expanded one, shrink again, and then we can meet again? So can it go like this?
It could. That would be... that could be some that would be some other diagram. You can imagine a diagram. So what would be the diagram where you expand in the future, but not so much in the past? In the past, it's okay. It's like our universe. So imagine it's our universe, and suddenly it starts accelerating. What could it be? So this means that it's a diagram where we can always meet in the past, right? In the past, we can always meet, because in the past, it's the same. But not in the future. In the future, there is a point, if we are separated, we don't meet again. So now you have some experience. Now it's trivial to draw. That space-time for the universe that decides to just grow at some point, but otherwise it expands a lot, is just a triangle. Right? Because now, at any two points, maybe I cannot meet in the future, it's possible, but in the past I can always meet. There's always a region in the past where I can meet. So you see that these kind of cartoons, once you get some experience, you just draw a triangle, you give someone a triangle, it says, oh, it's an expanding universe, and okay, in the past. No need to look at any tensors, at any vectors, at any big mass. This is the first thing you give someone when you are studying some spacetime. When you found, if I put this many matter here, it will deform space-time, create this wormhole, this black hole, whatever, then you are not going to give this your colleagues these big, big tensors. The first thing you give them is this Penrose diagram so that they know what it would be to live in subspace-time. Okay. Let me note that I could also draw these diagrams. I drew as a square where, I don't know, this is 0 and this would be the distance, x going there. But if we want to represent three dimensions, right, if I want to represent not only space and time, but to represent at least two directions of space and one of time, right, we could do it. Three of space and three and one of time, it's four dimensions, we cannot do. But three, it's still okay. We could do, right? We could draw the x, the y direction in this, and this would just mean that I would draw some sort of circle here where this is x, this is y, and this is time. Okay? And you can imagine this picture. This is like this. Take this diamond and you rotate it so that it does this three-dimensional picture. Right? This is just the 3D version of that. But of course, if things are invariant under rotation, there is just as much information in this picture as in any plane that it generates when rotating. But what I want to say is that this picture contains as much information as this one, that contains as much information as just drawing a single triangle and knowing that I get the full picture by just rotating this triangle around this axis. Okay? And normally this is the most conventional picture, because normally we don't live in one dimension plus one of time. We live in many of space and many of time and one of time. And then we just represent schematically this kind of picture, assuming we will rotate to generate the full picture. Okay? So I will now use this depiction to draw the diagrams, and I'm going to draw one more diagram. What could this diagram be? What could this space-time be? Let me draw one line to help you. There is some funny point here. Let's draw the light cone. Okay, and this is its light one. How would it be to live in this space-time? Here I am. A. Okay? So any guesses for what the space-time could be? What can I do? I can live quietly. I can just stay all my life doing nothing and living forever. And this would be my life. I start at minus infinity, I go to plus infinity, and I'm just doing what I do. But there is another option. Another option, the other option, this is option A, this would be option B, is to decide to go here and cross this line. Now, if I cross this line, I cannot get out of that line again. Okay? So what kind of space-time would this be? I can live my life as if nothing happened, or I can cross some surface and then, yes, Benjamin?
That would be a black hole.
That would be a black hole. This is the space-time, the Penrose diagram of a black hole. It's exactly a black hole. This line here is called the black hole. Someone knows? Wow, good. The black hole horizon. This is the line where if you cross, you don't get out. What happens when you cross the horizon? If you are, what do you feel when you are crossing the horizon? Most physicists would say nothing. We could be crossing an horizon of a huge black hole right now. We wouldn't know. Okay? But actually recently, a few weeks ago, actually last week, actually some very important physicists are saying that we burn as we cross the horizon of a black hole. This is kind of a blasphemy, but it's something that roughly every 2 days there is a response in the paper repository where we check all the papers every day, claiming that that paper is wrong and trying to disprove it, but it's definitely a paper that is calling a lot of attention and trying, and people are trying to figure out exactly, and no one knows for sure what crosses the black hole. But if the black hole is very, very big, then this horizon is very, very big, and the curvature is very, very small, in principle, nothing should happen as you cross it. You should just go untouched, and you would not know. Then at some point, you would start feeling the gravity force of the black hole to be huge as you are here. Because the gravity is so huge, your head will be pulled much stronger than your feet. It would start to stretch. Then your head would be ripped off. Then the head itself would be ripped off. Then the molecules, the part that is of the molecule that is closer to the black hole would be pushed stronger, so the molecules would be ripped off. And then space-time is ripped off. And it's not such a nice thing to approach a singularity of a black hole. But the horizon, no. The horizon should be fine. So people think. Okay, so we are halfway. So this is gravity, this is relativity, okay? This is half of the story. Then there's quantum mechanics, okay? Now we have half of the lecture, and relativity is the easy part. Relativity is the conservative theory. Quantum mechanics is the crazy one. Quantum mechanics is really an insane theory, and it's the theory nature works. It's the theory that nature follows. Okay, so let's go quantum, and then at the end we'll merge these two, but now we need to know some about quantum mechanics. Okay, so we are going to discuss quantum mechanics, which is a theory which, as we will see, changes nature or manifests itself more drastically for very small particles, even though it's a theory that governs small, big particles, doesn't matter. But as we will see very soon, only for very small particles it causes some drastic and very strange effects. So let's work with very simple particles, and the simplest ones, if you want, are particles of light. Okay? So light is made of particles. When we see, it means photons are hitting our retina, and if 6 photons or so hit our retina, we see a spot. Okay? So photons, so light, is made of particles. Which are called photons. And this is a fact. What's the difference between a particle? Why am I emphasizing that light is made of particles? What would be the other option? Would be if light is something like a wave, right? So like people thought at some point that light is actually some kind of wave that is propagating and not a bunch of particles. What's the difference between a particle and a wave? The way we detect it. A particle is something that comes in clumps, right? That it either hits you or it doesn't. It's ping or not. Whereas a wave, when you have a lake and you have some wave and you measure the height of the wave, there is some intensity that you can change gradually. It's not like it hits or it doesn't hit. And people can measure these particles of light. You can imagine a simple thing. You can have some photons, some of these particles of light. It can hit some plate, which has some electrons. And if it hits the plate strong enough, an electron could jump out of the plate. By the way, many of the ideas that I'm going to expose from quantum mechanics were taken from some lectures of Feynman and so on. So if you want to spend some good time, you can just go to YouTube, look for Richard Feynman, and it's just amazing. His kind of lectures on physics in general, it's really highly recommended. So how can we measure, how can we prove this statement that light is made of particles? Let me just start by that, because then we are going to use it heavily. How can we detect a single photon? It's hard, but we can do it. We can do a photon multiplier. So we can send a photon that hits a plate and might release an electron. Okay, but an electron is equally hard to do. So what to detect? How are we going to do now? We can put another plate, which has some very, such that there is a huge potential between the two, such that as soon as an electron is released from this plate, it is pushed very strongly to the other plate. An electron is now some heavy thing compared to the photon. Now the electron hits the other plate very strongly. But now it releases three electrons because it hits so strongly. And now you put another plate. And now this plate attracts strongly these electrons that release many more electrons, and you do it a few times, and at some point you connect to some columns and you hear ping. Okay? How do you prove light is made of particles? You put many of these detectors in this room and you turn off the light. Then you turn on the light just a little bit. If light was a wave, what would happen is that this wave will permeate this room and all detectors would start ping, 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 ping. And as you increase the light, ping, 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 more and more. If light were made out of particles, on the other hand, you turn on the light and some detectors are hit by particles, some are not. Then what you hear is very different. You hear some detector, ping, then some other there, ping, and so on. And this is a manifestation that what's happening is that light is made of particles that either hits the detector or not, and it's not a wave, on the contrary. So this is an experimental fact. Light is made out of particles. Now the next question is, how do particles propagate? What are the laws of nature that tell us how particles propagate? So you know the classical laws of physics, which are the ones that make sense. The laws that tells you that you throw an apple or you throw some ball and there is gravity and it just bounces, does some parabola, whatever. Or if it's in empty space, what happens to a particle if you kick it? It just goes into a straight line. So these are the laws that make some sense. You can imagine throwing a glass of water in empty space and the glass just goes straight and so on. The laws of quantum mechanics are kind of crazy. And this is how particles move in quantum mechanics. This is what describes the movement of particles in quantum mechanics. It's all about arrows, about these vectors, and about adding up these vectors. And the bigger the vector is, the more likely it is for something to happen. So let me illustrate this with an example. Suppose I have a mirror. I have a wall. I have something that emits photons. And the photon can bounce off the mirror and be detected. Now, the normal rules of classical optics or of classical particles would tell you that the particle goes, hits the plane, comes off at the same angle, right? So So if there is an elastic collision, there is this angle here is the same, it hits, it comes off at the same angle, and it comes to the detector. The laws of quantum mechanics are much more crazy. They tell you the following. Consider not only this reasonable, this logical path, but consider all other paths, the crazy ones as well. Consider also the paths where light decides to do something like this, or like this, or like this, or even coming back and then going there. Really insane. And consider all possible paths. Okay? So this is how quantum mechanics work. Can you redefine right here? Yes? No? Maybe? Good. One is draw all paths. Then two is the following. You have a path that goes something like this. You put a clock, you put a vector that is like this. Okay? And as you go, this clock rotates very, very fast. This needle rotates very, very fast. Okay? And when you reach the final point, the needle is therefore pointing in some other direction. Say this. This doesn't mean that it rotated from here to here. It rotated many, many times. But this is the final destination of this needle. Okay? Okay. This is what you do for each path. For each path, you do this crazy thing. Pick this clock, rotate many, many times. I'll tell you about the speed at which it rotates in a minute. And then you have some final thing. Then you add up all vectors. Okay? One for each path. So for each path, I have one such vector. You add them all up. And the probability for the particle to go from A to B is equal to the size of that vector squared, the norm of the vector squared. Okay? So these are the craziest rules you can imagine. This doesn't look at all like the kind of rules you are used to, where particles bounce off the floor and something. This looks just insane. So let's just see why these seemingly crazy rules actually give reasonable results. Why is this not so crazy after all? Okay? So you have to bear with me with this. It looks like I just went insane, but it actually makes some sense. So let's draw this mirror, let's draw this wall, and let's consider again all possible paths that go from the emitter to the receptor, to the detector. Okay, sorry, I'm drawing it again. Okay? And let's draw the time that it takes for the time that the clock will rotate as function of where it hits the mirror. Of course, this point here in the middle is the one where it takes the least amount of time. Otherwise, it takes more time. So this is the, let's call it the classical point, the naive one, the one that our intuition tells us. This is what we believe should be important. This is the part of the mirror where light reflects and comes back to the detector. This is our intuition. This point should somehow be special. And now let's suppose, as I told you, we draw the arrows for each possible path. So for this path, suppose I got an arrow like this. For this path, for the case, for the guy that hits this point instead of this one, well, the time is very different, so I got something completely different. For this guy, again, the time it takes is completely different. I got something like this at the end. For this guy, the path is again completely different. I got something completely different. For this guy, the time is different. I got something completely different. But now something interesting happens. For these points here, the time is not so different. The time that it takes for this, they don't rotate that much more. This one rotates a bit more. This one rotates a bit more, this one rotates a bit more, this one rotates a bit more. And now here we go again. This part is already quite a bit more different. This part is quite different again. This part is quite different. And this part is quite different. So we have a regime where time is changing a lot, where arrows are pointing in some sort of random direction. We have some regime where the arrows are all more or less in the same direction. And then some regime again, where because the times are very different, arrows seem to be pointing at the end in some kind of random direction again. Okay? Now let's add these vectors up. So again, adding vectors up, as I explained, just put one vector after the other. So we just start. Let's start. One vector. Now the next one. This one. Now the next one. This one. Now this one. Now this one. So I drew the first four. Now let's continue. No, not the first four. One, two, three, four, five. The first five. I drew the first five. Now let's continue. And the next one is in this direction. The other one 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 in this direction. So this is this middle part. And then here comes chaos again. Then the next one is like this. The other like this. The other like this. The other like this. So this is the start, this is the end, so the resulting vector is something that points from here to here. And the probability of receiving some signal from A to B is the length of this vector. Okay? Now you see what's happening. Was this middle part, this beginning and this end of the mirror important at all? No, because at that beginning and the end, the vectors were just pointing in random directions and canceling themselves out. So at the end, if I had removed this part of the mirror and kept only the middle part, I would just do this middle part of the arrows, and I would get exactly the same result. Okay? Is it clear? So the first part, so this is the first part of the mirror. This is the interesting part, the middle part. And this is the last. So this matches our intuition. If I want to see something that is there with a mirror, I just need a small mirror. Light comes and comes back. I don't need this huge part. This is totally irrelevant for a photon that comes to me. Right? So if I have this big mirror, I know that if I send the light signal that hits the mirror and comes to this detector, I should be able to chop off this part of the mirror, chop off this part of the mirror, and everything should be the same. And indeed, this part of the mirror, you see, I did it schematically, but in practice, it's even faster. And it's just, it's here, not doing anything. Then it moves a bit, then again, not doing anything. So only close to the point where it was minimum, because close to that point, it was not changing almost, the arrows were accumulating. And that's the statement that light hits in the middle and comes back. So out of crazy rules, we reproduce the usual rules of optics. That light hits and comes back, and the minimal distance that light can go is the distance that matters. Okay? Particles behave in the same way. Electrons, protons, and so on behave in exactly the same way. And these rules that seem so crazy reproduce all the classical physics, like this one that I just explained. But they can become insane and give extremely crazy results at the same time when we consider some other situations, like the one I'm going to explain. So again, this is how particles behave. To study how a particle moves from one point to the other, just do this trick with clocks and then add up all the possible clocks for all possible paths. And the size of the vector is the probability for that process to happen. Now, what about the speed of the clock? Does someone have any idea? How fast should this clock rotate? Does it always rotate at the same speed for all particles? Who said no? It's correct. Good. So what do you expect? Who do you expect to rotate faster? The clock. This clock rotating very fast. For some particles, the clock rotates like this. For some, it rotates like this as the particle moves.
Okay.
So what does it mean if this clock rotates very, very fast or very, very slow from this point of view? If it rotates, in which case would our classical intuition be more correct? In which case would it be really the middle part that matters? When it rotates super fast or super slow? Sorry? No. If it rotates super slow, then you cannot argue that in the beginning this part is irrelevant, because if it rotates slow, I can go somewhere here, then somewhere there, then somewhere there. If it rotates very, very fast, then indeed, only the part where it is almost not, where the time is almost not chance, has any chance of accumulating. Otherwise, there's no way it will, because it is so fast, it will just cancel out. So it means that heavy particles, the ones where we expect classical physics to be correct, like an apple, should have a very fast clock. Whereas small particles, like particles of light, where we might expect some crazy quantum phenomena, the clock can be a bit slower. And even for particles of light, high energetic particles of light close to the blue, or particles of light close to the red, have different velocities. Blue ones are more energetic, they rotate faster. Red ones, they are less energetic, they rotate a bit slower. And there's the full spectrum of light with X-rays and microwaves that rotate faster and slower, respectively. Okay, so we have these crazy rules. We saw that it gives classical physics, because in practice, what matters when they rotate very fast are the parts where the times are minima, like when the trajectories follow the minimal paths. But that's exactly what classical physics tells us, that that's how particles move. But we see that in reality, things are more subtle. If we take into account the fact that it's quantum, we have some different behavior. If we remove part of the mirror or not, the result will be slightly different. And this is quantum physics. But let's come up with an experiment where really our classical intuition would not work, and where we would get something that sounds kind of crazy from a classical point of view. Let's do the following. I'm going to do something that, for those that are taking notes, it's kind of annoying. But okay, yes? Sorry?
Did you say that if we remove the wall, the results will be different?
If we remove a bit the walls, if it rotates very fast, you would not notice the difference. But it depends how much precision you have. Right. If you really have a very, very good experiment, you would tell that you removed the wall. But let's come up with something where quantum mechanics would really manifest its glory and where you would see something crazy happening. And as I was saying, I'm going to do something that, for those who are taking notes, is not so funny, which is I'm going to use this picture for another example. Should I redo the picture? Would you prefer that I redo the picture? No? So let's do the following. Let's look here at this point. This point, the arrow was pointing in this direction. Okay? Let me change the arrows. Okay, that's fine. But this point, the arrow was still good. Okay. This point, the arrow was pointing in that direction. So what I can do is the following. I can go at these very different points that are here and see if the arrow is pointing in this direction, but here the arrow is pointing in this direction, and here the arrow is pointing in this direction, and suppose here the arrow is pointing in this direction again, in this different direction. Okay, so I have my mirror, and each path, the arrow that I would get would be pointing here or here. And what I will do is, with some blade, I would scratch this part out. I would remove this part of the mirror. Do a small hole or paint black that part of the mirror. That part does not reflect anymore. I would go and remove this small part of the mirror as well, because the arrow is pointing in this direction. And I would do it carefully by taking a mirror and removing the parts where the arrows are pointing in one direction and keeping the other ones. So what I will do is the following. Actually, I will do another picture. Let's suppose I have an emitter, and I have a wall, and I have a detector, and I have this piece of mirror here. Okay. Now I get almost no signal here, because I have this guy eating here, and this guy eating here, and you see the time that it takes is now some curve like this. It has no minima. So the values of the arrow here, it's something like this. Here it can be something like this, and they are all canceling out, and I get no signal there. My photo multiplier that I construct is never doing ping, ping, ping. It's always silent. But then what I can do is I can remove parts of the mirror. I can remove the parts of the mirror where the arrows are pointing in this direction. So I scratch alternatingly parts of the mirror. Now these parts don't reflect. Then what happens is that if I do it carefully, I only keep the good arrows, then they do add up to something instead of canceling. So this is after scratching. And before, I would get something where they are just adding up and doing nothing, so that at the end, I get a very small vector. Whereas here, at the end, I get some big vector. So look how crazy quantum mechanics is. You have a mirror. You have a photo detector. You see nothing. You start scratching the mirror, making it reflect worse, and you start hearing ping, ping, ping. So here is an example where instead of getting our classical intuition, we get something insane. We get something that you have a mirror that is doing nothing. We scratch it. We put a detector here, and we start hearing ping after that. This is quantum mechanics working. This is really quantum mechanics, waves adding up, interference, and so on. Something even funnier would happen. You see here, we did this scratching because we calculated how much we had to scratch, with what was the pattern we had to scratch. And we did it assuming some velocity, right? Suppose we did it for red light, okay? This would mean that if I throw red light, I would hear ping. But if I throw blue light, I would hear nothing. Because for blue line, this would not be at the right positions. They would still cancel out. So you can imagine this can be used for spectroscopy, for detecting colors, and so on. And indeed, this is a diffraction grating. It's exactly how people do. But now something fun happens. If you have blue, as we said, here we hear nothing. But then we can move the detector. We can move the detector to some other position. Okay? And it turns out that for this position, the spacing is no longer good. So now for red, we hear nothing. But it might very well be, and this is typically what happens, that on the other hand, for some other color, it is good. So for blue, we might hear lots of pings. Okay? And this is fine. This is just what we know very well. When we have a CD, which is exactly some piece of mirror where you remove parts of it, and you put the CD and you tilt the CD, you see different kinds of colors. And this is exactly this gratings and quantum mechanics working. Very good. So this is quantum mechanics. This is quantum mechanics. By the way, notice that I said take all possible paths. Do this funny game with arrows. This is the behavior of the world. But here, when I drew the paths, I drew straight lines. I could even be even crazier, right? Even more insane, really pathologically. I could decide to draw something that is not a straight line. I could decide to have some, this emits particles, this receives particles, and I could say I'll do this path. But I'll also do this one, I'll also do this one, and I'll also do this one, and I'll also do this one. How do I derive that they should move along straight lines? Again, the same reason. If I plot the time that it takes for each of these options, this is the straight line one. If it's not a straight line, it would take longer. Then again, the arrows would cancel out. Only for the straight line or close to the straight line, I would get something that would be visible, that would contribute. OK, but if light goes straight, how am I doing on time? Am I doing good?
We have about 20 minutes.
Only 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me tell you something else about... Should I tell you more about quantum mechanics? I should. You don't know enough to know about holography. So if light goes straight, let's try to measure exactly how it goes, where it goes. Okay. So let's throw light, receive it, and try to see where it went. If we sum over all these paths, if nature behaves in this crazy way, that particles more or less go through all possible paths, and what we get is like a sum over all possible histories of the particles, let's try to nail it down and see what path did light really follow. So let's send light from our detector, and it goes here to our detector. We know it goes through a straight line, so let's put some walls like this. Again, what does it mean that it goes through a straight line? It means that I could put another detector here, right? And I would measure nothing. This one would be all ping, 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 and this nothing. Okay? Since this is a bit subtle, let's see again why this measures nothing. Okay? Why does this guy measure nothing? So why does this one measure something? Again, because we have these paths. And if we plot the time that it takes, there is some middle one, some region where the arrows add up. Whereas for this guy, if we draw the paths that go here and here, okay, if you draw the paths that draw, if we draw the time that it takes, it's something like this. This takes longer, this takes less, there's no minima. So the arrows just cancel together. So this arrow is here, this arrow is here, but then this one is already here, and this one is here, and this one is here. So they don't add up, right? So because they don't add up, for this detector, I add up all the vectors, they cancel each other completely, and I end up with some very small vector. So I almost never hear a ping. Okay, but be careful, sometimes I do. This is how quantum mechanics work. It's very unlikely, but if I leave the detectors on, if I throw photons, I don't know where they go. I don't know if they go here or here. Nature doesn't know. Just with a small probability they go here, but with a big probability, because the vectors here add up, they go here. So with a big probability they go here, this can be 0.98, say, for example, and this can be 0.02. So out of 100 attempts, 98 go to the reasonable detector, but 2 go to the crazy one. And this is how nature works. But now, let's suppose we try to detect even better where light goes through. So we try to squeeze these walls and to make these walls very thin. Okay? Now what would happen? What would happen is that instead of having this big range of times, now I only have, say, this range of times. Okay? But now that I only have some small range of times, they don't cancel anymore. Now that I squeeze this, because I only have this, now the two vectors just add up. So this vector suddenly became bigger. So what happened was that light went straight. Okay, that's fine. I tried to squeeze to really show that it went straight. And suddenly the detectors that are down here start to ping, ping, ping. Exactly the opposite of my intuition, right? So normally I would expect that as I squeeze more and more, really the middle detector is the one that pings. It really goes straight. But it's exactly the opposite. The other detectors all start to go crazy and to ping. As I try to measure in quantum mechanics where something is, I get nature is smarter than us. And this is basically the uncertainty principle that you probably heard about. You try to measure very well the position of the light beam, you get a huge uncertainty in this velocity in this direction, and that's why you have no idea where it goes up. Very good. So this is how quantum mechanics work. So how does the real world work? How does an experiment at CERN work? Now we don't have just a particle of light. We have some photons. We also have electrons. Let me draw them with different lines moving in space-time. And then the electrons can interact with the photons. They can do all sorts of crazy stuff. There can be another electron here. And this is some history of something that could happen. What's this history? Two electrons were moving. One electron absorbed the photon. The electron emitted the photon and absorbed it back. Then the two electrons exchanged the photon. And then what you would have to do is attach small clocks to each of these particles that rotate, rotate, rotate. When the particles meet, the clocks give a small jump. Otherwise, they just continue rotating, rotating. Sum over all these possible histories with all possible splitting and absorption of all possible kind of particles. You sum this all up. And this gives you the probability for the event, for this history to happen, for these two electrons and this photon to become these two electrons in this case. This is, this picture, this cartoon, is what is called a Feynman diagram. And this, the science that does this, is not quantum mechanics, it's not relativity, it's what is the upgrade, is what's called quantum field theory. The next step after quantum mechanics. It's quantum mechanics for many particles. Okay, very good. Let me just tell you that this is really how nature works. You sum over all possible histories, say to do some computations for what is the outcome of experiments at CERN, you literally have to sum over thousands of diagrams, right? Because, I mean, the particles can go and exchange a photon. The particles can go and exchange two photons. And the more histories you add up, the more possibilities you add up, the more precise your results are. In the same way that with a mirror. If we add up all these histories, at some point it's not very important. The tails of the mirror, the probability for the photon to go to China, come back, hit the mirror, and go to the detector, that you can neglect. It's really not important. But still, the more you include, the better your result will be. The more you include, the better it will be. And here the same. And when we want to do an experiment at CERN, where we want to detect some process, which is whose probability is very, very small, like measuring a Higgs particle, you need to first sum up everything which is the most likely, and then subtract that to see the small deviation, the small bump in the data that is the Higgs particle. And for that, you really need, literally need thousands and thousands of diagrams. And it's a very hard theoretical and technical problem. And actually, one of the things that people try to do is to find out somehow, this is the story right now, but there ought to be a better formulation of quantum theory and of quantum field theory. Not only this is a kind of way too crazy, but that's fine, that's how nature works. This is too hard to do. To compute all these diagrams is very hard to do. But okay, you suffer, you use computers and you compute it. But then there is the final results are extremely beautiful. They're incredible. I mean, you waste pages and pages and pages, and then the final result is like some beautiful expression, like half a line. And it really tells you that there must be a way, somehow beauty emerges at the very end. When you sum all these histories, you get some beautiful distribution of particles in the detector with the angle and so on. But in the intermediate steps, this is really what you have to do and sum up all this. And this is for the history of particles, but there's actually something to be said about the history of nothing. What's the history of nothing? What's nothing? Nothing is just empty space, as we were saying. But empty space is much richer than it looks like. Because even for empty space, if we want to study what is empty space, we also have to sum over all possible histories of empty space. And what do I mean by this? I mean that in empty space, I could have what's called a particle and an antiparticle form and annihilate. And I could have photons creating and annihilating. I could have photons creating and, or this is not really a photon, but some interacting particle, some gluon or whatever. I can have some electrons. And I have to sum over all this. the vacuum that looks very quiet to us, it's in fact completely like a dense of particles creating, annihilating all the time. This is what the vacuum is. So the vacuum is all this complicated structure that give it some energy. Because of this bubbling, there is some inherent energy of the vacuum. And because matter and energy are the same, and as I told you, geometry is deformed by matter, all this big energy will deform space-time. And this will give it this accelerating or not accelerating nature. And one of the big challenges in physics is to explain the precise value of this vacuum energy. Very good, but now we have the tools we need. We have quantum mechanics, which as I told you, as I warned you, it's insane. It's the sum over histories, clocks rotating, adding up arrows, and so on. And we have general relativity, which describes curved spacetime. Questions? Is it clear or are you totally lost? Now let's put the two together. Now let's have black holes, and again, I'm going to do this very annoying thing of using the same pictures, but now I really have absolutely no time to do otherwise. And let's study the vacuum in the presence of a black hole. Now we have the black hole, and we sum over all these particles creating and annihilating themselves. So we have the black hole here, and we have to have all these particles that create and annihilate themselves floating around. Okay? But now you can imagine something funny happening. You can have such particles that want to annihilate and create happening close to this horizon. And then something fun happens. If something goes inside an horizon, it cannot get out. Right? So what happens is that you create this vacuum stuff, but one went inside, now the other one is alone, and will just go away. So what will happen is that some guys, they went to the singularity, bad luck. Some other guys went away and escaped. So it means that if you have a detector there, you see stuff coming out of the black hole. Ping, ping, ping. So this is the first surprise from quantum mechanics. The black holes are not black. It's not like everything that comes in doesn't come out. No, the black holes, they have some temperature. They are emitting these particles. And this is something called Hawking radiation. That some of you might have read from books. It is a phenomenon that virtual particles create in pairs. One goes inside the black hole, bye-bye. The other one goes out to infinity to our detector and makes ping. And this is Hawking radiation. So it means that the black hole, it has some temperature. Okay? The black hole has some temperature. So black holes have some temperature. So they are like a piece of burning coal. Like some piece of coal that you have that's burning and emitting photons because it has some finite temperature. And because it has temperature, we can study its thermodynamical properties. We can study its specific heat. You know what specific heat is? So the energy that you remove or take out of a system and so on. We can study the system as we can study a piece of material when some experimentalists do. And we can study stuff like so what is temperature? Temperature is a measure of something very hot close to something very cold means that if I put the two together, there is a huge transfer of heat from one to the other. So temperature is basically how easy it is. Differences of temperature is how easy it is to extract energy from one system to the other. Now, there's something else in thermodynamics which is called entropy. An entropy is a measure of the mass of some system. So we all know that if we put some gas in some corner of the room and let the particles evolve, they will occupy all the room in a big mess instead of being tidy up in some corner. And basically, we can measure the entropy, which is the degree of the mass of how many degrees of freedom, how much mass can I do in some given region? And that's a thermodynamic property that by knowing the temperature and the mass of the black hole and so on, I can extract. So we can compute, its entropy. What do we get? Let me before tell you, what do you expect? So if you have some room, and if you do a huge party and a huge mess in the room, books all over, clothes all over, CDs all over, you get a big, big mess. If the room were twice as big, the mess would be twice as much. The number of things you can do to mess it up is just double, right? Now you can put strings attached to all possible directions, and there's just twice as much volume. So what you would intuitively expect is that the entropy is something like the volume of the black hole, okay, times some numbers that to compute them you have to go to university. Huh? So you expect, okay, this is the hard work, I'll have to study a lot, otherwise it's just the volume. Well, the big surprise is that this is totally wrong. And the result is indeed some number that to compute it you have indeed to go to university. And if you go, you find it's 1/4, but that's kind of irrelevant for what I'm going to tell you, times the area of the horizon, times the area of the black hole. And this is kind of amazing. It's really, really very surprising. We have a system, we increase in size, but the number of degrees of freedom, the number of things we can do with it, the number of states it can be, its properties only grow with the area of the black hole. And actually, this is some property. I'll go 5 minutes over time, if that's okay. And actually, this is a property of nature. The maximum amount of mass you can do, you thought you could do as much mass as the volume of your room, but it's not true. The maximum mass you can do in some given region, the biggest you can do is what the black hole does. The black hole is the biggest possible mass inside the black hole. He's really champion in creating a huge mass. And you cannot do better. And the reason is simple. Entropy, this disorganization, always grows. This is a physical law, right? So if you let particles evolve, the entropy is growing. If you let a glass break, the glass breaks and disorder increases. Black, it always grows. So suppose you were doing a party and had a huge mess in your room. It was indeed very, very messy. But what I can do is I can throw even more stuff inside till your room becomes so heavy that it forms a black hole. Okay? So before black hole, big mess. After black hole, the mess must be even bigger. But when you have a black hole of the size of your room, the mass is just area over 4. And because it ought to have increased, right? This is really the maximum you can have. You cannot have more than this, because if you did, you would throw stuff inside, suddenly a black hole would form, but that would mean it would have decreased. Right? So if the mass inside was bigger than the area of the room over 4, as you throw more stuff inside, block, a black hole forms, and it decreases, but that's impossible. So it means that you can never, in a region of area A, have more entropy than area over 4. Now, in practice, because the number here is very small, you don't see these effects. But again, this is for very, very extreme situations. But then, this tells us something crazy that we learned by combining relativity and quantum mechanics. It tells us that the world, we have some volume. We are living here. We are in this room. There is some volume. But somehow, the quantity of information that we need to describe ourselves, the quantity of bits of information that tells the positions where we are, all our degrees of freedom, it doesn't require a space as big as the volume to store. It only requires a surface that surrounds us. So it means that the surface that surrounds us contains all the information about what's inside. And this is the holographic principle. It's the principle that you have reality with gravity and quantum mechanics and whatnot in our three dimensions plus time. But this is described, it must be described by the degrees of freedom around the big sphere that you can draw, like an imaginary sphere, which only has two dimensions plus time. And this is the holographic principle, this crazy idea that reality should somehow be some kind of an hologram. And that to study space, in some region, you should be able to draw some kind of big, big sphere. Inside this space, you have black holes. You have planets going around black holes. You have particles creating and disintegrating. And you have all the stuff. So you have general relativity. You have quantum mechanics. And all this theory of quantum mechanics and general relativity should somehow be described by a theory that lives on the boundary of the space-time. Now, this is just blah, blah. This is just the maximum of hand-waving so far. We reached the maximum. Now I'm about to tell you something which is really funny, which is that the theory that you get in the boundary, that we know what this theory is. And what turns out to be absolutely remarkable is that this theory in the boundary is quantum mechanics. Just quantum mechanics. Not quantum mechanics and gravity, just quantum mechanics. So you have just quantum mechanics on the boundary of your space-time. This is the description of reality, if you want. And it describes the world inside some surface, but that world contains quantum mechanics and gravity. So one answer to the problem of unifying gravity and quantum mechanics is the holographic principle, and it tells you that quantum mechanics in a big surface describes gravity and quantum mechanics inside the surface. To explain you why, that will be another lecture, but I am willing to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you. Questions? I have a present.
Pedro.
Yes.
If what you're saying is that according to holographic principle, you only need two dimensions plus time.
That's true.
Why does string theory need nine plus time?
Okay, so
where does that dimension come in?
No, I think that. Okay, so let me first. So I noticed that I never used the word string in my talk, right? But it's true that what do I mean by quantum mechanics, by general relativity? Is there some theory that does describe both at the same time? There is. And it's called string theory. And what happens is that string theory is a theory of strings, small loops of energy, if you want, that move inside this sphere. And if you want strings that move in empty space-time, the only strings that are known live in 10 dimensions. So there are examples of this holographic principle where strings do move in 10 dimensions, but the way it goes is the following. You have two dimensions plus one of time in the boundary. Inside, you have the usual four dimensions, plus a sphere of six dimensions that adds up the remaining dimensions that we're missing. Okay? So what happens is that in the simplest examples, the ones where we can do computations, we don't get 2 plus 1 dimensions here in the boundary and 3 plus 1 dimensions here in the interior, which is called the bulk. We get something funnier. We get 3 plus 1 dimensions in the boundary plus a sphere of 5 dimensions. So it means that each point of space-time, at each point of space-time, I could move in 3 directions in time, but there would also be a sphere with extra dimension. And if that sphere would be very small, I would not see it, and then I would go back to the usual dimension. But in fact, it's not very easy to make this sphere very small. But this is just a technical point, that in the known examples, indeed, string theory likes to live in 10 dimensions, and then what you do is you make the other some of the dimensions small, and you don't see them. Like when you are when you have some string, it is a three-dimensional object, but you only see one dimension. But actually, it is possible to make string theories in four dimensions. It's just harder. More questions? It's a bit hard to tell what the mechanics and GR
is. So you're saying that everything according to holography is written on the boundary of the surface in which we're living, and it's only written in quantum mechanics?
That's absolutely striking and amazing, and that's the reality. That's our best theory right now. To describe even our best definition of string theory. String theory is this beast that we know corners of, but we don't really know how to deal with it. It's not like we have some crazy but at least well-defined rules like quantum mechanics. No, string theory is even harder. You have more or less the rules, but it's still more or less under construction. And this, if you want, gives a definition of what string theory is. String theory is defined by quantum mechanics, by the holographic principle. Yeah, this is indeed striking. You think that you have gravity, you have quantum mechanics. Now you have to go even more insane to unify both, but it seems like you need to go more conservative, which is remarkable. You can throw away gravity and get it for free. And so one of the main areas of research in theoretical physics right now is understanding this black box. You see, now, I mean, it's really like a box. You have this crystal ball, and you read it from the outside, you are at this sphere, and this is quantum mechanics, and you have the inside, and you need somehow a dictionary, because I'm telling you there are two descriptions, quantum mechanics here, and everything inside. But if I want to operate with this crystal ball, I need to be able to read it, right? It tells me, it speaks to me in some funny language. I need to communicate and translate what I get from the boundary description and from the bulk description. Bulk is interior. And I need to establish this dictionary. So there is a dictionary between boundary and bulk that needs to be established. Okay? And people start studying simple things. Putting a black hole inside, what does it mean from this quantum mechanics point of view? That's one question you have to understand. It turns out to correspond to put the system to heat it up, turn on the heater, put some temperature inside, okay? Like we do in the winter. That corresponds to putting a black hole inside. What about two black holes inside? Well, it corresponds to your theory, heat them at two different temperatures in two different regions. What about scattering particles? You have to establish all this dictionary to understand. And then you want to study all these possible crystal balls, all these possible theories that have this holographic description of gravity. To make a catalog, to understand, do we have one that is really realistic and that describes the world we live in? Right now, not yet. We have some simple examples that do describe quantum gravity. So from that point of view, we know how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity, but not yet in a realistic scenario, not yet in a realistic theory that looks exactly like the one we live in. But then the problem right now is a problem of studying all these possible quantum mechanical boundary theories. It's a well-defined problem. It's not a problem that you need to... It's a well-defined problem that many people are studying. If I know very well these quantum mechanical theories, what does it tell me about the space of quantum gravity theory? More questions? No more questions?
Super. Let's thank Pedro again.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.